Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Having an athlete-centered approach to working with the whole person, weaponize your strength and reduce a weakness. Don't be afraid to look outside of the specific sport that you are coaching and interested in.
So welcome to our first episode of a series of interviews that we're hopefully going to be doing over the next 6 months, interspersed with our other podcasts, and that is around the coaches. And Ross has been traveling around the world over the last couple of weeks and has spent some time in places like Costa Rica and most recently in Boulder, and very shortly he'll be in Washington as well, and got a chance to speak to some of these coaches. And the idea really, Ross, is that we're going to be chatting to these guys because many of the athletes that we speak to have a lot to owe to the coaches that get them to the top level of the sports that they're involved in.
Yeah, and also coaches are the ultimate practitioners of sports science. In fact, sports science almost exists to support coaches. If you trace back some of its origins, sports medicine and sports science came about to optimize the performance of athletes who were already working with coaches. So they are the ultimate carriers of sports science into the real world. And that's why it's always useful to speak to the best of them and understand how they think, what they think, what their process is, and then how they deliver results to athletes. Because every single person listening, you know, you might not be Rowan Dennis, you might not be an Olympic triathlete, but the principles that make them better are the same things that will make you better. So that's really the intention of the series.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we are aiming to speak to a variety of coaches across different sports. And I think for those of you that are interested in the intricacies of coaching, you'll get a lot out of these interviews. So the first interview that Ross did was while he was in Boulder in Colorado in the United States, talking to Neil Henderson, who is one of the most respected endurance coaches, not only in the States and Australia, but probably around the world. He's helped a lot of first-time finishers and has coached several national champions, multiple world champions, and several Olympians. Most importantly, he was awarded the Doc Councilman Coach of the Year Award by the United States Olympic Committee in 2011. That was for using science in his coaching. He's been an elite USA triathlon and USA cycling certified coach and was the 2009 USA National Cycling Coach of the Year. Very recently, he's coached Rowan Dennis to the bronze medal at the Olympic Games and the time trial, and also coached Dennis to the UCI hour record in 2015, along with Evelyn Stevens, who also got the hour record in 2016. He's been a regular member, staff member of the 2012 and 2016 Olympic Games as a cycling coach, and went to Australia with the Australian cycling team in Tokyo very recently. And his job now is as head of sports science at the brand Wahoo. So a man with lots of experience. And of course, himself also participated as a professional athlete from 2000 to 2003, specializing in exterior and winter triathlon. But Ross, I think most importantly, from the discussion that you're about to listen to, a great in-depth insight. We were planning on a fairly short interview with him, but I think what you got out of that was quite intricate and detailed stuff about what it takes to bring an endurance champion to the top level of the sport.
Yeah, a couple of things jumped out at me with Neil. The one was I went to his house to do this interview because, as you said, he's now head of sports science with Wahoo. He used to run a sort of training facility, testing facility in Boulder. And I remember going there 5 years ago and being quite impressed by Neil and his application of sports science. And so when I had the opportunity to interview him, I thought, okay, let's do 20 minutes, get some principles, learn a little bit about how he applies sports science. So that's why I was at his house, by the way. So you'll hear a couple of times his dog barking in the background and that sort of thing. He took me down into his man cave where he does all his indoor training and Zwift and that sort of stuff as well. But what struck me were the two things. One is the depth of knowledge. But within that, the way that his philosophy has evolved over time. I thought that was particularly interesting. So you hear that. And the other thing that I think is quite meaningful is that my intention and his intention were to talk about the physiology and the science, but there came a point where almost every single question, even if it was about physiology, took a sometimes 90 degree or otherwise arced in the direction of psychology and mental factors, emotion, and so on. And it became almost inescapable to talk about physiology without also talking about psychology. And after a while, you start forgetting that you're dealing with a physiologist who has a master's in sports science, and you start thinking this person is actually applying sports psychology and emotional support to athletes. And that's actually a theme that I've realized in a couple other interviews I've done. I said to Bobby McGee, who's a triathlon running coach, who's one of our other guests on the series, does he consider himself as a technical support to the athletes or a motivator? And he said in the beginning of his career, he was technical. Now there's no doubt that his main function for the athlete is motivational. So that was particularly striking. And it was, and you'll hear when you hear Neil, we almost couldn't answer a question without touching on some aspect or a very deep aspect of emotion, depression, psychology, arousal. So yeah, that really did jump out at me.
Well, here is Ross's interview with Neil Henderson.
Okay, so Neil, thanks so much for your time. I jumped into your life at late notice, and you've accommodated me even with your equipment, so I really appreciate it. You've been coaching 20 years, and I'm sure your philosophy's evolved a great deal over that time. Would it be fair to say you came to coaching as an athlete or as a scientist, or what was your initial paradigm?
Yeah, my initial paradigm came from being an athlete myself and then thinking about some of the applications that I was being exposed to in the sports science realm. I had a really influential swim coach who had a master's degree in exercise physiology and would share with us a bit of why we were doing what we were doing in training. And especially the thing that I remember the most was something about tapering. And I asked a lot of questions, and she's like, well, let me just bring in a paper for you so you can read yourself and have some more understanding.
And this is pre you being a student.
I'm 17 years old, okay. High school senior. And that was a huge introduction. And another aspect of that was I competed in track and field, and I was more of a thrower to begin with, discus and javelin, and I really wanted to be a pole vaulter, and we didn't have any pole vault coach. And so I started to kind of like look up and read as much as I could about pole vaulting, and ended up actually probably being a better pole vaulter than anything else I did in track and field, and actually continued on and did some decathlon because I didn't know when to say when, and just tried to pick up and learn new things. But a lot of that was looking at information that was out there being supplied by different coaches in certain aspects.
Out of interest, what was the tapering thing that you remember? Do you remember specifically?
It was the particular thing was just the reduction in volume and what we were doing, because we were a fairly low volume swim program that I was that I swam with, which again at the time, you know, most swim programs swam a lot more than we did. We had limited access to pool time. So we had 1 hour, 5 days a week. And so it was 4K in that hour pretty much most days. So it was very high quality, but low volume. And then, you know, knowing that so many other folks were swimming much more, that now we're all of a sudden we're coming into a big race, and now we're cutting that in half. We're doing, you know, 2.5K versus 4K a day. Was like, oh no, we're not going to be ready. And she's like, no, you're going to be more ready because of this.
So you're an impressionable 17-year-old and you learn some coaching theory. Did that influence your decision to study it, or did that come later after you pursued the career as an athlete?
Yeah, it was part of the driving, kind of opened the door to it. I had a little bit of an experience as a 16-year-old with my family actually getting to tour the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs and seeing that the sports science building, and actually got to talk with somebody actually in the biomechanics department who was analyzing race walking, which not a sport I was terribly interested in, but being able to see the motion broken down in a way where they were trying to discern the differences between the different athletes, and especially the Americans at the time weren't doing as well in that. And there was opportunity for them to improve. And so they were assessing what was different between basically certain race walkers versus those who were more successful, and being able to then use that to coach and change the mechanics that the athletes were utilizing.
It's interesting because when I was 15, also I visited the Sports Science Institute. I showed up there. We were on vacation, my family and I, in Cape Town, and my parents knew that I was interested in sport. And they said, why don't you, we had some friends, they said, why don't you go and visit, see if you can. So I invited myself. And it was also, for me, one of the most foundational experiences was getting a tour of the building. And there was one person in particular showed me her lab and what they do, how they test and so on. And I'm pretty sure that it was the catalyst as well. So you had a sequence of the same things. It's very interesting.
Very similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then the journey begins. I know you were a competitive triathlete. At what point did you study the sports science as opposed to experience the sports science?
Yep. When I started my undergraduate, I actually started off in an engineering program because I wanted to go more into the biomechanics side. So I was in a mechanical engineering program at Penn State University, which it's one of the better engineering universities that we have here in the U.S. And the math was at my limit, I would say. Mm-hmm. And I was still having that goal of being in the applied side in the sports science realm. And I had also been taking one of the first exercise physiology classes. And it was that combination of like having that class. I was actually also coaching then with that same team and with the same coach in the summer prior to my sophomore year, that it was like, okay, I think I'm going to actually switch more to the sports science department and look more on the physiology and applied coaching side of integrating that kind of information into learning how to make athletes go faster.
And did you, when you then did that, did you instantly know that this is what you needed? Or was there a period of actual letdown, searching, refining?
There was no question, actually. Okay. It was a very clear, absolutely, this is the right fit. This is the stuff that I'm most interested in. And it's kind of like when I stopped doing track and field, I talked with the head coach. I had tried to walk on at Penn State my freshman year to track and field and doing decathlon specifically. I had done a couple triathlons in high school because I came from, swim background and just wanted to do lots of different things. And the head coach said, listen, you're going to be pretty low on the selections here. Basically, you're not going to have a lot of opportunity. And I left that meeting kind of being like, wow, I had not had a coach really just be that, direct. In a way, it felt just like putting me down. But, it's just the reality of what I had to offer and where the scale of the other athletes were in that. And I went out for, a ride, and I'm thinking things through. I'm like, okay, in 5 years, when I'm graduated, hopefully I'm graduated at that point, what would I do on a weekend? It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to like pull out a pole vault pit and go pole vaulting on a Saturday afternoon or go out and throw the shot put after work on Tuesday. I had done some triathlons. Like, well, I like to go out and run and swim and ride. And, I've had some fun doing that. And for me, it was kind of like a switch into that sport because it was something I could do then for the rest of my life, is the way I thought about it. And within the sports science and that shift from, kind of the engineering and mechanics side of it into the working more with people in a kind of a holistic way made the same kind of perfect sense of like, geez, actually, that's really what I want to do, like apply and help.
So just to orient me, you're how old at this point?
Basically 19, 20 years old.
And you're learning about sports science. You're in the early stages of learning it. Can you remember if you were struck by a disconnect between what your coaches were doing and what you were learning? Or were they good in the sense that you could see them applying what you were learning in the classroom?
Yeah, there was a little bit of a combination. Some of it was like retrospective, looking back at coaches that I had had who both very much did not have any basis in sports science in what they did and how they did things, as well as then seen a little bit of those who were. So like my high school swim coach, and I had gotten into triathlon at this point, and I was actually kind of got involved with the triathlon club at the university, and in a way kind of took on a role as coaching that club. I was elected as the president, I think, my sophomore year, and you know, there were, I think, six folks when I joined the team, and by the time I left the university, there were 40 kids involved. And so it was teaching and coaching, and also having a purpose, which was part of then, okay, applying some of the principles of sports science, progression and specificity and things like that into what we were doing.
So that was the point at which you transitioned from being purely a consumer of information to a provider.
Yes.
And can you remember what your early principles or philosophies were around that? If you were to meet yourself at that point now, would you be impressed by your coaching approach or not?
I would say I wouldn't have even had a really well-defined philosophy at that point. It would have been, I'd say if I would meet myself from that period of time, I would be impressed by my enthusiasm and basically doggedness at looking and consuming and pulling in information and potentially being able to distribute some of that and motivate others and help to some degree. But I think I would say I was still underinformed relative to the grand scale of things, and some of the big picture. Maybe I was still stuck exclusively looking at a physiological realm on certain things or a certain mechanical bias and taking away then the neural aspect to things.
Right.
So less integrated, I'd say, with channels being super, you know, more important and maybe neglecting some of the other things that connect them.
Do you ever have a sensation or feeling that your younger self thought you knew everything? Because when I look back, if I think back on my own philosophy, even of sports science, I remember consuming information and going back to a coach that I knew back home who was one of my early influences. And I remember being so impressed with myself. And I thought I had all the answers. And I explained to him all these things I'd learned. And he just looked at me. He turned over, he grabbed a book off the bookshelf. He said, 1968.
Yep.
That was written in 1968. We know.
Yep.
And I remember being really humbled by that. And it was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I would say for sure I was pretty proud of all the things that I thought I knew that were, I was thinking, you know, that you're I was on the cutting edge, when in some cases I was very much off the
Have you seen that curve of the Dunning-Kruger effect that shows confidence plotted against knowledge?
I had extreme confidence.
Yeah, and you're at that first point because you gained a little bit of knowledge and now you're super confident. And then as you gain more knowledge, you actually lose confidence.
Yeah.
That's where you'd want to be.
Yeah, and I think some of it was also interesting being involved in a sport that was fairly new in a way with triathlon. I actually volunteered then with the first national team for triathlon in 1996, just came out on my own, paid my own dime for 2 weeks and just took in as much as I could. There was the head coach at the time was George Dahlem, a PhD exercise physiologist. And again, I was learning so many things that when I got home, man, I thought I was the, you know, that I knew everything about triathlon at that point then.
Yeah.
Which again, I knew more than I had before I left. But boy, it was still, again, that's still going back, you know, over 20 years of experience that I've had since then.
So, okay, so let's jump ahead. We'll fill in the gaps. Going backwards again. But if I were to say to you now, with the benefit of 20 years of experience and humility, what would you describe your coaching philosophy as right now?
Yeah. I can go through like a certain list of things that are critical, but having an athlete-centered approach to working with the whole person, using a combination of sports science principles and practical information. To help athletes improve their capacity to perform and to develop the mental skills to perform.
Okay, so we have to deconstruct that.
Yeah.
I'm mindful also of the fact that many people listening to this are coaches and sports scientists, or both, like you. But there are many who are not sports scientists or coaches, but they wish to apply things to themselves. So they, by definition, are athlete-centered. So let's begin there.
What does an athlete-centered coach do that a non-athlete-centered coach is not doing? What's the mistake or set of mistakes?
Yeah, I'd say in some cases it's adherence to like a dogma or a method or a system of doing things, regardless of whom you're working with or what those athletes are doing. And so just having a super rigid structure of you train this way, that there is only one way. So to me, the athlete-centered part means all of a sudden now you need to pull in bits of information with respect to that person and what they're trying to do, where they're at and what they're trying to do.
Can you give us a couple of examples that illustrate it? And you don't have to use names and so forth if you don't want to, but I'm just curious about where you've experienced that play out in two athletes needing quite different approaches.
Yeah. I'd say there's an athlete that I'm working with now who's a younger under 23 cyclist, and he comes from a background in alpine skiing and more strength and speed sports. And he had worked with somebody who had a little bit more of an endurance training background. And literally, if you think about, you know, kind of a fast twitch dominant athlete and somebody who's much more slow twitch dominant, and some of the things that they need to do in training are a bit different to optimize that performance, even though the task may be the same. And so for me, looking at the athlete and what their history is and what their capacities are relative to the task does change the way I'm going to approach how I'm going to work with them and what we're going to focus on in training, both to develop and in some cases, like I'll often say, weaponize your strength and reduce a weakness or not focus on your weakness and ignore your strength, but actually make what you are good at to be the thing that you're greatest at, and then minimize the cost of the thing that may hold you back in some cases.
So that's an interesting paradigm. And it's similar to, we spoke recently on the podcast to Stuart McMillan, sprint coach. I'm sure you know Stuart. Yeah. And he said the same thing. He said, a lot of times people will observe an athlete's performance and say, if only they fixed X, Y, Z, focus on the weak point. And they don't recognize that actually there's a cost benefit there to maybe you focus on that to the detriment of the strength. And I remember asking Stuart this question, so I'm going to ask it to you again, is sometimes you do have to address the weakness because the athlete will never reach the ceiling without that. Yeah. How do you balance your prioritization in these cases?
Yeah, so there's a part of assessing the athlete, what they're doing, what they've done in competition, and kind of you having, you know, the ideas of what are the barriers to their performance, and then actually having honest conversations that are sometimes, you know, not comfortable, and asking the athlete what are the elements that are holding them back the most. What do they feel is kind of preventing them from having the kind of success that they want to have? And sometimes you think one thing and they think something totally different. And it's like, ooh, okay. So there's some opportunity here of what their barrier is and what I'm seeing as that barrier that I need to address what they see as the issue, as well as in some cases, you enlightening them of this is what I'm seeing and being able to provide some level of evidence to support like what that is. And then you have a lot more opportunity to improve from those two different perspectives, rather than, again, a non-athlete centered. Again, if we pull back to that, it's the athlete is a very important collaborator with you.
Yeah, for
not
sure.
Top down,
for sure.
That it's right. Collaborating together to see, you know, because that's ultimately, you know, I think super critical to being able to help an athlete improve. And in some cases, it's going to be addressing a skill set, a capacity, or a psychological barrier or a lack of competence, as in some cases being the most critical thing. If you can replace that lack of competence with true competence, not manufactured false bravado kind of, but real deep confidence, then man, so much more possible.
That psychology bit's super interesting, and we're definitely going to go there. So I want to park that for now. I want to come back. You speak about the conversation you would have with the athletes, a difficult conversation, like what do we need to change? I suppose you're always asking that in the context you understand the event, whether it's your work you've done in 1 hour records, whether it's a Olympic road race you've just come back, I know, from Tokyo and a bronze medal in the men's time trial. Someone listening to this who doesn't have a coach, they need to have that conversation with themselves. Is that possible, or is that maybe the single biggest thing that a coach brings, is an external perspective? How do you interrogate yourself?
I would say it's very difficult, but in some cases possible. Not everyone potentially is able to go to that completely honest place. Mm. I'll be honest, I've not had a coach in the sport of triathlon in my entire career. And I raced at a high level, again, you know, professionally would be in quotes, because I, you know, worked full time while I was doing it, because I knew kind of where I was in the pecking order of things. But I raced at the elite level and have continued to do some events here and there, and you know, with some success. And I would say I probably would have benefited from having some more objective viewpoints presented to me, and having accountability and working with somebody else. But the big part of it is somebody else objectively able to look at what I'm doing and be able to provide then the right kind of guidance to where those opportunities were, again, both in what strengths I did have, as well as then where maybe I just had blinders on things that I didn't address appropriately then.
Yeah, so I suppose the moral here is get other opinions.
Yeah. And again, it doesn't have to necessarily be a coach per se, you know, a you know, licensed professional coach in your sport, whatever. Okay, you know, somebody that's gone through a coaching course and, you know, dotted their I's and crossed their T's doesn't necessarily mean that they actually have all the skill sets to be a good coach. They've taken certain steps towards potentially being able to do that, but it's somebody who has actually some insight into the sport that can be actually providing that kind of guidance for you.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the athlete-centered bit. Now, I've kind of lost track in my own mind of what you read there. The next part, I think, involved scientific principles.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we talk about athlete-centered, we're talking about being agile and responding to the athlete's needs, personalities, demands, life, and so on.
Yep.
The scientific principles must be rigid, I guess.
Yes, in some way.
In your application thereof.
Correct.
What are those principles? I mean, and to what extent are they negotiable?
Yeah, so it's kind of looking at being informed by what is out there in sports science research and literature. And so where certain bits of knowledge that can inform and guide your practice, whether that's a fueling and nutrition related issue. So there's certain things you can look at, multiple carbohydrate type, to have a higher intake of carbohydrate compared to like a single source, as something that would be an example of like a research informed application, then into a coaching recommendation for fueling for somebody doing an Ironman or long distance event. And so it's just across that continuum of different elements, and there's long-term athlete development as potentially aspects there. There's going to be the physiological principles of with intensity and looking at heart rate, power, you know, all those different types of things as other elements that the research that's out there can inform how you apply that into your coaching, to a workout, to targets, etc.
So you're trained to do that. I mean, that's one of the, I've always thought my university education taught me how to consume information, and specifically how to filter out bad information. How does a listener who's not necessarily trained as a scientist go about finding information and then filtering out what they shouldn't do in order to focus on what they should? Any advice?
Yeah. Looking at trusted sources of information.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some things that are just textbook, you know, reading through his, you know, individuals who have had success in sport, both from a coaching and from the athlete perspective as well, and where that information, where they've kind of gathered their process and applications of those things would definitely be, I think, a way of being able to consume and in, some of that information. And these days now, something like listening to this podcast is a great example of where you can gather some of that information from sources of people who have been involved in utilizing.
Yeah, fair. I mean, that's, I've often thought the biggest challenge today is the internet has made information so pervasive and easy to access to the detriment of quality information. It's for every one good thing, there's 99 bad things available to people.
Definitely.
What magazines used to do, the internet now does 1,000-fold more effectively.
And rapidly.
And quickly. So that's an important principle, is textbooks, not marketing material.
Yep.
What are the textbook coaching principles that, in your mind, underpin every successful program?
Well, I mean, there's some of the discussion of, you know, coaching types. If you think of, you know, democratic coaching style versus an autocratic coaching style, and some of those different aspects within that. If you think of like a laissez-faire coach who kind of lets an athlete discover on their own and kind of sit back, might in some cases be actually pretty functional for a high level athlete who's been in for a while that sometimes needs to think things through on their own a little bit. With a youth, say high collision sport where injury is a risk, I don't think that that's necessarily the best thing. A laissez-faire wouldn't be super functional in that way. An autocratic style to keep everyone healthy as first and foremost step would probably work out for parts of it. But I think that there's different ways that coaches interact with athletes over time, and figuring out where there's a good coaching relationship of what an athlete is looking for, as well as what a coach can provide. And and so that's kind of an interesting thing. If you think of like working with a coach and coach selection, to me, you know, any athlete who says, I would like you to, you know, coach me, it's a, well, I need to interview you too to see if we're going to be able to work together. And I've had athletes at times where they were developmentally at a point where I couldn't provide what they needed and had to say, you know, I can't give you what you need to be able to help you. I would love to, if we could be in this style of working together, but where your needs are over here. And so I'm going to have to say, like, you know, here are some people who I think might be a good fit for you.
Yeah.
A better fit for you for now.
Interviewed actually Trent Stellingworth, you know, Trent from Canada last week, and he spoke about it as a marriage. And he said that in the early phase, it's like dating, but you don't want to spend a year on what's going to end in a nasty divorce. So you have to find ways to accelerate failure so that you fail early, so that you don't waste someone's time and your own.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, and we put this in the parking lot earlier, did you ever study psychology, or have you kind of learned people on the job?
Yeah, a bit of both. So even though I did my undergraduate in exercise and sports science, I think there was probably maybe one, maybe two psychology, and I think a basic psychology and then a sports psychology as like required things. I took additional electives in sports psychology, and in my master's degree at CU Boulder here, I didn't have to take any sports psychology classes, though I did on my own add those because I wanted to learn more, understand more. And then I'd say throughout the process of coaching, learning and seeing other coaches, how they interact and working in different sports even, has been something that definitely informed that viewpoint. And ultimately, I would say, you know, I could get 10 genetically identical individuals with the same, you know, just starting materials and get 10 wildly different results in the same event based on really psychologically where they were on the day and the preparation they had, the skill sets they developed, et cetera. So to me, that psychological component, I mean, one of those 10 might not even show up. And it's all, you know, due to not the physical preparation, but that the psychology and what's going on across the entire continuum of the mental.
So. Can you think of any, you mentioned other sports and your observations of other coaches. Could you give us any examples of a coach who's done something? He said, that is impressive. That just blew me away, the way that coach got so much out of that athlete.
Yeah. Really good example that I have is actually Bradley McGee. So he's he had worked with the Australian team. He himself as a as an Olympic gold and silver medalist, and has had a wonderful career as an athlete himself. But he's actually working a lot in coaching education now in Australia, and he was actually kind of last minute pulled back in to help with this Olympic team. There was some staff some health issues among one of the staff members, and had a basically a last minute pull Brad back in, and he came in and just did a fabulous job, and just being able to pull together all the athletes as well as then other support staff to be in that athlete centered environment at the biggest,
How did he do that? What was it about him? Is it a personality?
It's a personality. Communication style, personality. There's something that can be said for, previous experience that he had, accomplishments he's had and people respecting how he's carried himself through all of that is part of that there's a level of respect there for both the accomplishment, but more so who he has remained as a person and how he values and basically, includes everyone in that team as a critical and important member. And I think that's, when people feel good, about themselves and about who you're working with, or in some cases for, it's a lot easier to do what it takes in that way of like, just put a little bit extra effort in and maintain a good, just a good general vibe, without any better way of putting it, like just having that, those good feelings are, A, immeasurable, and B, critical to some of the highest levels of success that I've seen.
So it's fair to say that the athletes, they liked him and they respected him, and he had a technical competency that was sufficient or better than sufficient to get results out of them. But a big part of that's personality. And someone listening to this is going to go, but I don't have that personality. I'm not that guy who can walk into a room, or woman who can walk into a room and just captivate people. I'm not an Olympic athlete champion in the past. So I guess the question is, how does a person find their style as a coach?
Definitely. And so I'd say instead of it just being a personality type that's going to have that success, it's actually being able to connect and show people that you care in a way that isn't necessarily a verbal thing, that they know that you're there for them.
Okay.
And you're going to help them, that there is that level of trust that can be confidently gained and maintained.
Right.
And doesn't need a recurring reinforcement that, words sometimes are said, but the actions don't match the words. And so that, to me, it's those actions and how somebody is carrying themselves across different domains that shows that kind of they're trustworthy.
Yes, and it has to be sincere, because you mentioned like a few seconds ago you have to make that effort. And if you're making that effort in an insincere way, then you're effectively acting.
Yeah,
and that's going to be exposed.
Absolutely. Just as I was talking about with the confidence thing, deep confidence versus false bravado.
That's on the part of the athlete, but it's the same thing.
And a true connection and communication versus a kind of like saying what I should, or the words that, I should say, rather than what I truly connectedly can say and communicate.
And I suppose at the risk of being blunt, and I know many listeners of this podcast do coach, especially kids. We've received questions, and I'm going to ask you one of them in a moment. But if you find yourself a coach and you're not naturally inspired, and you are finding that you have to pretend to be invested, then maybe that's not actually where you should be.
Yeah.
So that should actually come naturally.
Yeah. That has to be that's a critical element to having success and to being able to lead others in that way and ask people to do challenging things, difficult things.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
On that note of the kids, I mean, you've obviously coached at Olympic level, seniors, but you've worked with youngsters as well. How do you know when to drive a youngster, push a youngster, as opposed to pull, as opposed to hands off and don't do anything?
I'm trying to think, is there like a perfect decision tree to use in that regard? Absolutely not. And that's something that takes some time to develop. And I would say taking cues, if you do work with young athletes and seeing in some cases how their peers are looking at a situation and being able to read, you know, because sometimes, let's just say a kid's had a rough day, you know, at school, and the other kids know something happened. You might not have that awareness in that moment. But if you can see and read a feeling from those other athletes that are around, and it, again, it might be more of a team situation where that's possible. You can like slow things down and, you know, maybe not even say anything in that moment right there, but redirect what you were, you know, thinking was going to be the right action. And then be able to check in, you know, after the training or something, you know, as an example like that. There is no absolutely hard and fast though decision tree. I think it is having an awareness though, and just watching how your athletes are moving. A big change from what is normal for them either way, you know, in some cases like, whoa, they're really like ramped up today. Like what's going on? Like they usually don't do this. Like it's not always, you know, for the best reason why that, you know, change in behavior occurs. And so,
I mean, this is a sort of a left field question, but you're a coach, you've worked with athletes at the very top level. When you see things like Simone Biles in Tokyo and Naomi Osaka recently and prior to the French Open, how do you interpret those athletes' reactions? I mean, now this has gone psychology now more than anything else, but your perceptions are interesting to me because you would have a filter as a coach, a lens rather, where I don't have that. So
For me, I would say 100% in support of those athletes, knowing that there's so many things that are going on in their background that I have no awareness of, and understanding the real reality of that intensity and pressure. And if an athlete who is there, you know, anybody who is at that level is a committed individual, has made sacrifices, has put things out there, you know, in many ways, even in some cases, like on a, you know, multiple time daily basis, like their health is at risk. And if they make a decision that I need to back down, that's actually like the wisest decision they can make, and 100% support at that point, and find out really what has caused that. Is then okay pulling back, and afterwards there's going to be, you know, whatever, a post-mortem, however you want to describe it, of like, okay, how did we get to this point that it came to a head here and now? Were there things that were along the way kind of missed and swept under and not addressed early enough, or was it just there was a certain, you know, series of things that just happened all in concert that hit that point where, you know,
it had to have been. And the thing that struck me with both those examples and with others, I mean, because obviously now we work primarily with endurance athletes, and Tom Dumoulin, similar thing in cycling. Yeah. There have been a few others, actually. There was a sprinter, was it Kittel?
Yep.
Marcel Kittel, similar.
Yep.
So now you're dealing with, obviously, psychology and potentially these are big deals. Yeah. But the thing that strikes me is that when people talk about this, they seem to imagine that it's like their class at school, and there's 30 kids and 29 of them lack motivation.
Yeah.
These people are not those that these people do not fall into that category.
No.
And so you think, oh, she's being soft, she's being weak. And so, like, if these people pull back, there's a big deal there.
Yeah.
So, That's Neil's. Yeah. That's Sky.
That's Sky. One of our three, my little miniature dog pack here.
I arrived at Neil's house earlier and got a very hostile,
loud
greeting from Sky, who's now found someone else to be friendly to.
Yep, she talks.
Yes. Anyway, that's segue aside. I mean, we went down that rabbit hole.
One thing I'd love to add on that, I think a lot of times people in popular culture think that coaches have to be that authoritarian autocrat, my way the highway, and that's what's celebrated out there, and that's what the general public often think of in sports, you know, are that tough guy coach or gal who does it, and the athlete is also then that same, they just need to buckle down and get it done. It's like, well, neither of those things, I in my experience in elite sport, are true. That the
right, but that's because, and I don't mean to single out Americans now, but that's because the understanding and perception a lot of people have about coaching comes from American film.
Yeah.
And so you watch Any Given Sunday and there's that famous speech. You watch Friday Night Lights and the coach has this, he's almost like the mayor of the town. And you call them coach.
Yeah.
And they do have a certain pinnacle status that has been, and that's not really reality.
Popular culture then kind of seeping into, and an expectation then placed upon all these other sports athletes and coaches that is then hard to shake.
Okay, I mean, fascinating psychology, but let's track back to the physiology and the science side of it. Have we done justice to your philosophy? I don't want to leave that before we talk about other things.
I think that you know, we've hit on most of those things, kind of that practical methods. So the other thing is, like, I see a lot of times a lot of young coaches, like, oh, there's a research paper out on this, and these intervals are the magic bullet in some way. It's okay, where do they fit in the context of the progression and development that the athlete's on, the needs for the sport or event that they're preparing for? All those kind of things. It's you know, it may be a wonderful workout, but where does it fit in the big picture? And for that athlete specifically, have they done something very similar to that they, you know, telling them that something else is better when they've had good experiences with something that's a little bit different? Like, why would you go ahead and change something that's working?
Right.
And so again, I see that some cases that it's, you have to have that combination of, you know, research informed but practical application and you know, how we do things in the real world.
It's human nature, though, for especially young coaches to pursue innovation, when the reality is that actually good coaching is you have to be patient and sometimes quite boring.
Yeah, repetition and consistency pay the biggest, you know, the consistency pays the biggest dividends over time.
Right.
For sure.
So even when you're not doing necessarily the very best thing, you're better off sticking with it than chopping and changing to what you think might be better. Would that be accurate?
Generally, yes. Yeah. It's not always entertaining.
Right.
In that way.
Would it be fair to say, and I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, if I'm wrong here, say so, 20 years in now, There must be very little about physiology that surprises you when you work with an athlete. Like, you know the event. So say it's an hour record. You've had Rowan Dennis broke the men's. You've had Evelyn Stevens broke the women's.
Yep.
If someone came to you now and said, we want to do an hour record, you know the formula physiologically.
Yeah.
So what challenges you as a coach now?
Yeah. The things that challenge me now are a little bit more some of the tactical domain of things. And so, you know, a few years ago I was working with a long course triathlete, and I've worked with actually a lot of triathletes over time as well. That's something that I have enjoyed doing, but I kind of shied away from long distance because it was kind of like, it's just like run the red line and, you know, whoever crosses first. There weren't a lot of tactics being employed, and there are more now, but several years ago I had this athlete, Joe Gambles, and I said, listen, you know, for this one race, we're going to employ this strategy. We're going to pace the bike very differently because this is the course itself. Who's in there? What, you know, what I think they will tend to do. You can do this kind of work, recover here, hold steady there, and you should have a gap in this range that then will allow you to run your pace through, you know, if not the entire run, a large portion of it, and then potentially be able to respond if needed. And he was willing to, again, do something tactically different than he had ever done. And on the day, again, it worked out well. It was a great, you know, he won the Boulder 70.3 race. And it was fun to see a plan with tactics relative to some combination of his physical ability and physiology and then the competition and who was there and what their kind of strategies we'd seen play out be put into place. And that to me is super exciting.
So you've almost, it's like you've achieved a degree of mastery over physiology, and now it's a question of how do I play tactically with that.
Yeah.
What between say 2001, 20 years ago and now, what's the biggest changes that have happened in sports science that have impacted on your coaching?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking like wearables. You know,
yeah,
like
exactly. Right now, everyone has a quantified data set of information. Yeah. Some maybe, you know, higher, might have more pieces to it. But I actually have my first heart rate file from an Ironman race I did in 1999. And I still have that. It's every 5 seconds. It was a Polar. But every 5 seconds for that, you know, Ironman race, I had that heart rate download. And it was something that actually informed me about pacing and a failure of my pacing personally on that day. That now is just standard, you know, and that's not just the heart rate. It's power output, cadence, speed, you know, whether it's running, all those kind of things, and as well as then on the bike, and in some cases, you know, in swimming, there's certain metrics that are being tracked a little bit more, as well as then all the fun recovery type things, getting not just to sit in the morning at breakfast and do a resting heart rate, but boy, you know, sleeping, resting HRV in conjunction with resting heart rate and the load and the work you've done and some models that are trying to, you know, assess or accurately maybe reflect the work that's being done. That is such a massive scale change in a way that's, it's exciting, but you can get lost.
Yeah,
if you
focus
and put a microscope on something that doesn't matter.
Right. Completely overwhelmed by data. Have you found that the people you train and work with are, Do you have to use a different approach because they have their own data and they're saying, coach, I mean, look at this, look at that, and so on. And, you know, they're so informed.
Definitely.
Without expertise.
Yeah.
So
when, I mean, this is the case that a lot of folks look at things that don't matter. They spend inordinate amounts of time and energy analyzing things that are irrelevant.
So, such as what? I mean, let's give our listeners three tips of what not to waste your energies on.
Yeah. If you're looking at like your power duration curve or something to that effect, you know, or peak power on every training session and tracking some sort of a log of that versus, you know, what you did last week and last month and last year, you are spending a lot of time on things that don't matter. Training is creating a level of stress. You have to have rest and recovery and an adaptation. So for me, it's the change in capacity over time and potentially an interrelationship of a couple of variables, like how fast are you running at the same heart rate, you know, for a steady state 10-minute effort? How much power are you producing for, again, a similar perceived effort or heart rate? And how fast are you going uphill? Because that's then some combination of your weight, your rolling resistance, your aerodynamics, all of those things. That's the stuff that, you know, having some occasional benchmarks that you use to assess those changes, not the daily, am I better than I was last week, last month, like that. You have a less frequent.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're not really using all this technology in a way that's different to how you might have used it in 2003.
Correct.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, we just have 10 platforms to do the same thing where we had Excel back then. Or I only had Excel.
I mean, heart rate variability and sleep?
Mm-hmm.
You find value in that?
I think so.
Yeah.
And this is part of the then, you know, part of many years ago, if I knew what I know now, I would say, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I know 100% that this is high value. And mm-hmm. now I would say, I think there's a value in this. Mm-hmm. And it's something to incorporate with these other trends.
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting because I'd say out of every 10, what do we want to call them, attributes of these devices, any one matters. Mm-hmm. Yep. The question is which one?
Which one?
Yeah.
Yeah. And which one is reliable?
Yes.
From that as well.
Yeah. Are there any others? I mean, I sort of steered us in the direction of wearable tech. Are there any other paradigm shifts that have happened over the course of your coaching career that are noteworthy?
Yeah, I think there's been those shifts in now people looking at trying to assess recovery as a critical factor, where, you know, 10 and 20 years ago it was much more looking at the load, what work was being done and quantifying that. Now we have so many different tools of being able to quantify that. I still don't think we have a great way of truly representing the entire load that is placed on an athlete from all the perspectives. So I was at a conference some years ago and somebody was like, oh, what's the future of sports science? And, you know, somebody's like, oh, aerodynamics. And somebody was like, muscle oxygen. And it's like all these little things, like those are devices that already exist right now.
Yes.
Like I actually had almost every single one of those, like in my backpack at the time. I was like, yes, all nice tools. I'm like, the thing we don't have is a psychometer, a good indirect continuous monitor of what's going on in our head in a way that's useful. Now we can do, we can go through questionnaires. There's some really good, you know, different things that require a discrete measurement, but we don't have a real good, you know, kind of somewhat continuous, non-invasive way of assessing what's going on there. And I think that's actually, you know, for the future.
And if you had that, what would you want it to tell you? What would its top three outcomes be for you?
Yeah, for me, it would be looking at the associations between where there's high performance and what are the attributes that we see repeating in high performance, as well as then the opposite when there's poor performance and what are potentially the things that are.
Are we talking here like flow state, zone, that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And looking at those differences between, you know, excellent, great performance and actually the opposite, the worst kind of performances. And then again, it's kind of like, look at the extremes for me, is where you want to see more, you know, where you can potentially see more difference in something rather than like in the middle, a little bit this way, a little bit that way. Give me the absolute best performance, absolute worst. And what are the things that may be, you know, associated with, again, associated, not necessarily cause effect.
Could a listener of this podcast now take that and do anything in their training to understand their own psychometry?
I think so.
And what would that be?
Putting some tag words along with good performances and bad performances. Mm. And
are we talking about, I'm cycling now up left-hand canyon and I'm having a great day.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of what I'm thinking. Then I got to write afterwards. I got to document what it was that
afterwards,
I was thinking.
Yeah. Or pull out your phone and just do a little voice note while you're doing it. Maybe even better.
And then the reverse is also like, I'm having a dreadful day. I've got lead in my shoes. Now I want to understand. And what are you creating there? Just self-awareness.
Awareness. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a high school cross country coach who, you know, when we did certain speed work would just say quick feet and just be there as we were doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's something that we got ingrained in when at a certain, on a course, he would be at a certain point and just be saying quick feet. I mean, Pavlovian in a way of having those words associated with. I built my own, you know, mantras and things like that I've used in different types of events, different times that you kind of revert back to. And in some cases, you know, there's power in that.
Can you tell us, feel free to say no, can you tell us, like in Tokyo with 7K to go in the Olympic time trial, and everyone, if you watch that, I mean, okay, gold was won by a guy over the horizon,
clear.
But from second to sixth or something was 5 seconds, or what was it? It was ridiculous.
And Roan was fifth. at 7K to go.
Okay, so
fifth position. So
if we could read his mind, do you have an idea what he's thinking?
We didn't know what he was thinking at that time.
And sure,
What we were though thinking about was the communication and what words and what information we were providing to him. It wasn't you're in fifth place. It's you're 7 seconds out of silver.
Okay, right.
You're seven seconds out of silver. This is now the time. This is what we've been preparing for. So specifically within that course, we knew it would kind of ride heavy and that the second lap would be, you know, the biggest difference. The uphills clearly would also be the biggest differences. And from that 7K to go to the finish was, you know, there's an uphill a little bit on the track with then a final uphill into a long kind of slight false flat uphill drag to the finish. So it was going to be whoever can close strong is going to be the more successful riders.
Yeah.
And so that was actually something that we practiced in training weeks, months leading into it, actually doing some virtual training actually with Brad in Australia, me right here actually at midnight on the computer, and Rowan riding in Europe and talking through some of these things and actually having video we had recorded in 2019 of the course itself, and had that virtual ride going on with Rowan increasing effort the second lap whenever we did two lap efforts. And so it was part of the entire process for a very long time leading to that event specifically, to have that ability ingrained. And for sure, it made a difference. You know, he closed from 7 seconds out of silver to 2 seconds out of silver and surpassed two people
Jumped onto the podium, right?
Yeah, put himself there.
And okay, another example then is Evelyn Nahr, Stevens, the 1 hour record. Did she have a self-talk place to go in the 45th minute with 15 to go? And you think, actually, it's the third quarter, right? It's from 30 minutes to 45.
Yeah. Yep. Push, pull.
That's it.
Those are her words.
That's
push, pull.
Okay.
And thinking about pushing into the pedals on the straights and pulling through the turns.
Oh, I think so that was going to ask
she
you.
She was just switching. It was a process oriented of focusing on what could she do
Who
to
came
manage.
Up? She came up with that?
That was all hers.
Yep. Okay.
100%.
Guided by you, like saying we need to think about what you're going to think about.
So she did have a mental skills coach as part of her team of people. And so I didn't know that before the race, like before the event, what tools she would be using, but it was, do you have tools and mantras, things that you're going to use? Yep. Okay, great. There we go. And that's the other thing as a coach, I think I would encourage those who are out there who are coaches themselves, and make sure that you do utilize other resources who can help you be a more effective coach. You know where your strengths are and know where you can bring others in who can help athletes.
Especially if you're athlete-centered, because then the athlete is... Because I remember this visualized as a solar system. The athlete's the sun, and then the planets are the coaches.
Yeah.
And you might be one of five satellites, planets circulating this...
Yeah.
Revolving rather around... It's not circulating.
Revolving around. Yeah, the first ever cycling world champion that I coached was a master's mountain bike racer. She was 49 years old in the 45 to 49 age group. She had won silver and bronze in her age group previously, and the year going into her 49th year, which again, top of an age group usually isn't a time
shouldn't
to go for
be,
it, but,
right, but
we knew she could do it, but we had to improve her downhill skills. And she worked with a downhill mountain bike coach 4 months leading into the race. We also played a little bit with her training and did like a hard week, easy week, because you work full time and you know, 2 weeks of progressive training was just too much for her. So hard week, easy week. She also lived at altitude. So there was all these things that we learned through, you know, not having failures necessarily, but not succeeding at that highest level, that we put into practice. And she had success for sure through that combination of all those things. She gained skills. She gained confidence in her downhill skills. She got to the top of the hill with one other athlete. And she won it on the downhill, not on the climb, which it was like, wow.
Great. So now you've learned that Evelyn's doing push-pull. Have you applied that to other athletes, or do you say, you know what? Do you apply the principle and say to athletes, I want you to come up with yours?
Yeah, the thing and practice an experiment. And I'll use an example. Rowan does a lot of counting himself. in time trials.
Yeah, he counts his cadence. I do that actually. Yeah. I count 100 on the right, then I'll do 100 on the left, or whatever it takes.
Yeah. And so it's like, what are the things that you can use, that you can practice to develop, that you can then rely on when everything else is, you know, when you don't want to be focusing on other things, something that you kind of focus on that keeps you in the moment doing what you're doing. I don't think of them as distractions. They're actually things that narrow your focus into what you're doing, not get you away from it.
I remember speaking with psychology, the mindset coach of the All Black rugby team. I mean, Americans, the All Blacks are the pinnacle sports team in that sport anyway, across all sports. And the advice they got given is early in the game, when you run out before kickoff, find someone in the crowd who's wearing a distinctive color, shirt, shorts, hat, whatever it is, and ground yourself by looking at that person. So that was what they used to do, was just reset mentally to stop yourself from being panicky or over-aroused or overwhelmed, whatever it was.
Yeah. Be in that right now, here, grounded.
Yeah. It's funny how I came here with the intention of discussing physiology and every question almost has veered towards psychology, which I think is quite meaningful.
There's an exquisite relationship there.
Yeah.
That without, you know, without one, you can't express the other.
Of course. Yes. And you can have all the hardware in the world and you won't realize anything with it.
That operating system has to drive it.
Yeah. So I want to wrap up because I've taken so much of your time and knowledge. Let's talk about three categories now. There are people listening to this who are coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Your journey was into coaching through as an athlete, sports scientist, and then you basically took over as a coach. What advice would you give that person to develop their coaching over the next 3 years?
Yep. Don't be afraid to look outside of the specific sport that you are coaching and interested in. I didn't even mention it, but I was a strength and conditioning coach with an AHL hockey team. So a league below the NHL, but the head coach actually went on to the NHL and some of those players. But I learned a lot. I never played ice hockey myself. I'm not a very good ice skater. I'm not great at stick and ball sports. And there were still applications and things that I learned in working with that team in an area where I could provide expertise because they use cycling as their off-ice conditioning. So I know cycling, I know fitness, was able to work with them there. But to see all the other things that I was able to actually pull from that, I think
it really forces huge. You to deconstruct and reverse engineer what you're trying to achieve, doesn't it? I mean, I know I went into rugby as a complete non-rugby expert, same as you with ice hockey. And the learning curve is so steep because you bring with you the principles you understand from your sport, and suddenly you have to, and you find ways to apply them, and you learn, okay, it didn't work here, it did work there. It's very useful. So when you say don't be afraid to look outside,
or in fact seek out,
that's what I was going to ask. Is actually say you're a football coach, tennis coach, listening to this, find another sport and volunteer for 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is. That's what you do.
Yep. Absolutely. It'll do more than you could probably imagine.
Mm. Okay, so that's your advice to the coach. A lot of listeners, I'm sure, are young sports science students. They are you in 19, whenever it was, as a Penn State athlete. Yep.
93.
What do you say to them? Because sports science is an odd world now, I think. It's overproduces graduates who then don't find what they were looking for.
Yeah. Find the things that interest you the most and tie that to where there's an application of that. So I've known a lot of students over time that come out with a massive knowledge base, but an inability to apply it and work with people and have an impact in that way. So make sure that area where you have interest, that you are able to find a way where it then applies and makes a difference.
So again, it's the same action almost as our first group who we advised is go and coach.
Yeah.
Just jump in.
Yeah. The number of volunteer positions that I had, you know, that I took in different ways to learn a skill set. Absolutely. All very invaluable. When somebody tells me that I want to do what you do, I'm like, okay, well, here are certain things you should do in that process. You're going to have to learn some of the things that you don't want to do.
Yes.
Like I worked in a biomechanics lab and digitized 3D, you know, coordinates for 40 hours one week, I'm like, yeah, I actually don't really want to be a biomechanist in that way. Mm. Like, that's not the thing that excites me.
Yes, that's the I mean, we were just talking before we even recorded about David Epstein. You've just finished the range, range. I know David, I'm seeing him next week. That's kind of what he said is he calls it sampling.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely critical. And it's not always doing just more and more of the things that you want. Doing some things that you're not sure of.
You know,
or even you may think like, I definitely don't like to do this, but you can still pull something out of it. Like I used to bale hay when I was in high school, you know, friend had a farm and I hated it. And I was, you know, got itchy, had basically an allergic reaction, but there was still something that was useful.
What was useful? What did you learn from that?
How you work together and how you can take that discomfort and manage it. So finding comfort in discomfort, I would say, for me as an endurance athlete.
Because it's hard labor.
Absolutely.
And you have no end point. So you learn to pace and manage your perception, your efforts, and so on.
Yeah.
Very good.
Being uncomfortable isn't the worst thing in the world.
Awesome. So, okay, so those two professional groups, the coach and the sports scientist, we're actually advising them, don't narrow down.
Yeah.
Keep do the opposite. Wide. Go wide. And then the last group is me, 40-year-old, self-coached because I'm not good enough to want to coach athletes, and I'm looking for ways to improve.
Yeah.
An improvement might mean finishing a marathon. It might mean breaking 3 hours for a marathon. So we're going to cast the net wide here. What advice do you give those people based on your knowledge?
Yeah.
Maybe that's too wide.
Yeah, there's a lot, but I would say one of the things we see repeated over and over with a lot of, you know, say masters type athletes who get in, they have a goal that they want to achieve, you know, X, Y, and Z thing, whether it's to finish a marathon under 4 hours, they want to do the Leadville 100, they want to do something, and they get stuck on the output required to do that rather than working with where they're personally and physically, physiologically at, and assessing what are the things that are going to be most critical for them to address in the preparation for it. And in so many cases, if it's those kind of ultra distance things, fueling and pacing are like number one and number two that mistakes are so consistently made. And another, just from a physiological perspective, like endurance training being done too hard for general endurance work. I would say I'm fairly well known as being a low volume, high intensity kind of proponent.
Okay.
And I would, to a degree, absolutely agree with that. But I would also counter and say I do believe it's absolutely critical to moderate intensity to the lower end of things for endurance training.
Yeah.
Most people do what should be aerobic training in the kind of moderate range, and that leads to a lot of problems and lack of development, lack of improvement.
So just so that I understand exactly, you said you got stuck on the output side. So for example, what's the mistake they make?
Trying to hold a running pace.
Because they know that their goal was a 3:30 marathon, and that works out to, what's that? That's 210, that's 5 minutes a K.
Yeah.
Or 8 minute miles.
Yep, 8 minute mile.
And
so training, they never want to slower than, say, an 8:30.
Okay, so they don't. Got you. Okay.
And if you think about, I've explained it as like a training relativity that, you know, elite marathoners, this is way back, you know, they used to run a 2:10 marathon was fast. So, you know, that's a 5 minute mile pace. They're doing long runs at, six and a half minute miles. So they're running 20 to 30% slower than marathon race pace.
Mm-hmm.
So your average person, if you're trying to run an 8 minute per mile, relatively speaking, 20 to 30% slower is now talking a 9.5 to 10 minute plus mile pace.
They feel it's a waste of time.
And that's the same relative intensity as the world's best.
Right.
So unless you believe that you are more physiologically gifted and capable than the world's
best, that load,
then there's no necessity in going faster than that for your endurance runs.
Yeah.
Now, yes, you do need to do some intensity that is faster, but when you do your endurance training, if you're not training at your appropriately easy pace, you're going to short circuit all the other work you do, and you're not going to get the gains that are possible otherwise.
How do you know you're doing that? As a non-coached athlete, you've only got yourself to rely on. I mean, how do you know?
Doing the old school talk test, Carl Foster. If you can't actually have a conversation with your, you know, if you're if you're running with somebody or riding with somebody and you can't be at a conversation pace while you're doing that, well, you're going too hard. Yes, you could use a heart rate monitor as well as another cross-check to that if you've done some testing or...
And what's your target there? Like, assessment. I mean, I know Stephen Seiler always talks about the zones and he wants you to be... I get the numbers confused all the time. He wants you to never be... He wants 80% of it below like a zone two, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you use that sort of system or?
Not necessarily as a hard and fast rule, because that 80-20, again, when you're talking about the volume of somebody who trains 20 to 30 hours a week versus your average person who maybe trains 4 to 8 hours a week, these are totally different. Like, you can't use the same percentage distributions for extremely high volume, elite, young, and a 40-year-old who's trying to...
Fair, you know, that makes sense.
Who's going to run, you know, 50K a week.
Okay, so let's try and capture, because we went on to some branches now. We want to capture that. So don't get stuck on the output.
Yep.
Understand that you have to train. You are allowed to train easier than you want to race at.
Yes, you need to.
You need to do it.
It will help you. Yes. It is counterintuitively the thing that will actually probably give you the greatest gains over time.
Right.
And you can't get there in 3 months.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did this was probably like in our first dozen podcasts, we asked listeners to send in the best training advice they'd ever received. And a lot of them were similar to that, is you don't have to perform every day in training.
Yep.
And you don't have to race the training sessions. And you don't, so that was valuable. And you've just said the same thing. So if you needed convincing, listeners, be convinced.
There it is.
Yeah. Is there any, I mean, I think we've covered so much ground. And again, it's so interesting that you're trying to talk physiology and we constantly go back to motivation, psychology, arousal.
Yeah.
That's really very interesting.
Definitely. That's the exciting part. I mean, even with, as a coach, you know, experience over time, you know, there's things that I've thought about were super important, but big picture, they weren't. So like 2008 Olympic Games, I was coaching Taylor Finney. He was an 18-year-old, you know, going there for the individual pursuit. And I was very data driven at the time. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even actually have a power meter on his bike until after the World Championships that year, where he ended up qualifying. So we started using it and my computer hard drive melted down when we were in Europe. He had already done the Junior World Champs in Cape Town, South Africa. We were training in Bordeaux for a few weeks before going directly over to Beijing. So I had no backup computer. And so the last couple week, almost 10 days of training was no data. And it was all just the pace, feel, and making the adjustments on the fly, coaching exclusively with my eye and being there in the moment and having, again, none of the data to use. And he had success, you know, he, you know, didn't win a medal at that Olympic Games. He finished seventh at that Olympic Games, but the following in, you know, March in 2009, he won his first elite world title in the individual pursuit and repeated.
It's a mature athlete sport, that's, I mean, 18, you know, seventh at 18 is something.
Yeah.
But I have to, okay, I thought I was out of questions, but you've just brought up something that made me think now. So with Rowan Dennis, you're sitting here in the room at midnight, you're simulating the course for Tokyo. Like, you're teaching him every 100 meters what it looks like, what it's going to feel like. You are being so meticulous in your planning. And then with Taylor, you're saying you were coaching by feel, there was no data and so on.
Yep.
Was the difference there the athletes? Would Rowan have succeeded on the Taylor approach, maybe? Or was it you?
Yeah, I think it's developmentally both where they were and where I was as a coach too.
Yeah.
I think both were part of that. And I can tell you with Rowan, I had to stop looking at some of the data or just know that it's not important, because I knew it wasn't important, but still have gotten that reinforcement over time of, say, things, you know, these training load values and just seeing it drop and drop, because we had, you know, just how the training was and what was available and everything. It was a precipitous drop in training load going into that race. And I knew it. I knew that's what we were doing. I knew that was the plan. But to still see it and not get that little bit of question in the back of my mind, knowing that he wasn't looking at it, it wasn't something that he cares about. You know, he trusts. He's trusted me over time because we've had, you know, success, and I'm there for him in that way. And it was still an interesting push-pull for me at that point where I've had all that. And, you know, more commonly, Ron had done a grand tour or some higher overload of training before then tapering into a world championship or other event. And this one was a, we didn't have that. We didn't do that. And just have to stay confident and not get, you know, clouded by the data piece.
Yeah. So you actually,
I was fighting my own.
Yeah, it's you're micromanaging everything, but projecting a big picture.
That's
the balancing act.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me that coaching is always a balancing act. There's always, but not just between two things, between five decisions, and you've got to make one out of five. And
yeah, yeah. What's the most important right now to address?
And then ask yourself questions. Did it work? Was I right?
Yeah.
How do I know if it worked? What does a failure look like?
Yep.
Which is, again, I say this all the time. It's not dissimilar to scientific process.
Yeah.
Hypothesis, intervention, evaluation, hypothesis, conclusion, whatever it is.
It's just the circle. It's the process. It's the process. And that's the thing. It's not the knowing an answer. It's you've been informed in that context now.
Right.
Where does the next step go?
Yeah. I think that is probably an appropriate way to end. So thank you for sharing your physiology and psychology with us. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Ross.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.